30% certainly going to be paid for by the state. Who knows what the increase will be next year, the following year, or in 5 years as the federal poverty guidelines go up.
The state Senate approves allowing more low-income Alaskans into Denali Kid Care health coverage, but not all are happy about it. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 3rd of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as commerce develops in the Arctic, Congressman Don Young pushes for more icebreakers.
With that increased maritime activity, the Coast Guard will need additional ice-capable vessels in the Arctic.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Fostering safe, connected schools is a foundation for academic achievement through annual school climate surveys. Information at aasb.org.
The Senate today approved opening up the Denali Kid Care program to more low-income Alaskans. The bill would allow children from families with an income of double the state poverty level to take part in the medical care program. Anchorage Democrat Betty Davis, the bill's sponsor, said as of today, 1,277 children and 225 pregnant women will be added to the program. Majority Leader Johnny Ellis said Alaska does not stack up well against other states, even at the new levels. He says many other states have opened their programs to even more children. The federal government pays 70% of the program's costs. Anchorage Democrat Bill Wilikowski said the state's increase can be made because the federal government has increased its appropriation to the program. He said the new level of service will save money for all Alaskans because it reduces the unnecessary strain on hospitals who have to treat uninsured patients.
We did a legislative research request, Mr. President, and we asked, what is the cost to the state of Alaska just from uninsured children alone in increased premiums for the state of Alaska? It's $3.5 million. And that's just the cost that we're paying in increased premiums for uninsured children. The cost to the state for uninsured people a couple years ago was $125 million for everyone, uninsured premiums.
The minority Republicans voted against the measure, focusing on the 70% participation by the federal government. Anchorage Republican Con Bundy said the Kid Care program still costs too much.
I suppose it is a case of glass half full or half empty. But one third or 30% is certainly going to be paid for by the state. And who knows what the increase will be next year, the following year, or in 5 years as the federal poverty guidelines go up.
The bill passed on a 13-3 vote. After a reconsideration vote on Monday, it will be sent to the House. Alaska Congressman Don Young is continuing the call for more icebreakers in the Arctic. Young made his comments yesterday at a markup hearing of the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. They were working on a bill that would authorize appropriations for a new icebreaker in the Great Lakes. Young supports funding the vessels, but said it's not just the Great Lakes that need more icebreakers. He said the situation in the Arctic is critical.
As the ice in the Arctic Ocean recedes, if it does so, for longer periods during the summer, shipping in the Arctic will increase. With that increased maritime activity, the Coast Guard will need additional ice-capable vessels in the Arctic.
The U.S. has three icebreakers that can be used in the Arctic, but one is out of service in Seattle. Of the other two, the Polar Sea is more than 30 years old, and the Healy was designed mostly for scientific research and can only travel through ice 4.5 feet thick. That's compared to Russia's biggest vessel, which can cut through 9 feet of ice. Russia has 9 icebreakers for Arctic use. Alaska's congressional delegation has pushed for more American icebreakers. Congress has worked on authorizing a study of the Coast Guard's need, but Young says they must move past doing studies and start building new vessels.
We need to get the Coast Guard to stop thinking and start doing. And I hope you'll work with me to address this polar icebreaking needs of the Coast Guard bill this year.
Coast Guard members have told Congress that as traffic increases in the Arctic, icebreakers will increasingly be in demand. A bill changing the law governing cruise ship wastewater discharges passed Alaska's House yesterday. The measure continues to require the state's stringent standards for water released directly into the ocean, but it allows regulators to temporarily adjust the standards to a level that can be achieved by available technology. The legislation changes terms of the cruise ship initiative passed by voters in 2006. Its rules measure pollutants at the point of discharge. Cruise ships sought to allow mixing zones, which dilute discharges before they are measured. Bill author John Harris of LD's Republican says his legislation lets the Department of Environmental Conservation adjust to the realities of the business.
This puts in statute the ability of the department to allow a waiver for these cruise ships to dump in Alaska waters until it's economically feasible and technologically feasible for the ships to put this technology on board.
The bill also creates a panel of scientists to advise the state on new technological developments. Harris's measure passed the House on a 32-2 vote. It's already scheduled for a hearing Monday in the Senate Resources Committee. That's an indication that the bill is on a fast track for passage. Juno Democrat Beth Kertula spoke against the measure on the House floor. She says it is too open-ended.
One of the things that I remain most concerned about is the fact that there is no final deadline, there's no sunset, there's no absolute requirement of having this finalized. And we have been known and trust in those kind of deadlines so that we can get our work done, that we can be done with it.
The latest version of the bill was a compromise that included backing from authors of the initiative that set up the standards. Further changes may be made in the Senate. Most cruise lines have been able to meet the new standards, though some have had problems with ammonia and dissolved metals. But stricter rules kick in next season. Industry officials say they will have a hard time meeting those standards. That could result in route changes that could reduce the time and money spent in some ports. Some fishermen express concerns that the bill would weaken protection of their stocks. Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas says he shared those worries, but decided to go with the compromise.
I'm fishing in those waters when these cruise ships are going to go by. And I had some language in there previously, and it was taken out that there won't be dumping when commercial fishing boats are in the area and visible. But I'm just hoping that they will consider that, because I fish probably in half the water that they go through when they're traveling throughout Southeast.
Many businesses dependent on cruise ships supported the measure. Ketchikan Republican Representative Kyle Johansson says the final version took into account tourism, subsistence fishing, and shellfish harvesters.
I appreciate the fact that the sponsor introduced this legislation, ran it through the committee process, received input from the regulators that make the decisions about this, and came to a delicate balance, something that we can live with, that balances the environment with the economy and moves us all forward for a positive solution for Alaska.
The bill attracted a dozen co-sponsors. 4 of 5 Southeast representatives voted for passage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Governor Palin visits Ketchikan with a new message.
There is no nowhere in Alaska. Alaska is all potential. It's all good people. It's all potential resource development.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The advisory panel for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council developed recommendations yesterday regarding Chinook salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery. The council is trying to decide if it should put a hard cap limit on the number of Chinook caught as bycatch. The council is meeting in Anchorage, and KUCB's Ann Hillman reports that the problem is not as simple as deciding whether the cap should be as high as 87,000 or as low as 29,000 Chinook.
It's about the little things. If the council decides to impose a cap, that limit is allocated to individual boats. boats with more pollock quota have higher bycatch caps. Some of the smaller boats would be limited to about 50 salmon per year.
And it's possible with somebody with a 50 fish allocation of Chinook to catch it all in one tow and totally by accident, you know, with the best of intentions. We call that a lightning strike.
John Gerber, who works for the pollock catcher vessel advocacy group United Catcher Boats, says the problem with caps is that one accidental lightning strike will stop a small boat from fishing the rest of the season.
But whenever a boat reaches its allocation, it must stop fishing until it can find an additional allocation through transfers. And one thing that happens as these caps get ratcheted down, the opportunity to find fish to transfer to you becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. So it becomes increasingly punitive to small vessels.
But small and large vessels alike would have the chance to increase their individual allocations through salmon savings incentive programs. For every 2.9 fish they catch less than their limits this year, next year they can catch an additional fish over their limit. They can save up fish from one year to the next as insurance for the next lightning strike. That is, if they choose to participate in the incentive programs. Those programs are optional, and the council cannot determine what exactly they involve. But Gerber thinks most will choose to join.
In an incentive plan, you know, people are going to always be thinking about where the bycatch is because they get a reward down the road for it. So these incentive plans are much better, and they're not really at the 68,000 fish hard cap. They're at the performance standard of 47,000.
Others don't see it that way. Becca Robbins-Gisclair is a member of the advisory panel and the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. She tried and failed to get the panel to recommend a performance standard as well. She wanted the hard cap limit to be reduced to 38,000 Chinook if 38,000 was exceeded for 2 of 5 years.
There's no real means for the council to control which incentive programs eventually go in and what's comes through when this finally is put in place in 2011, and that's where the idea of a performance standard is really necessary if we're going to go forward with this, to make sure that there's some ground truthing of what the incentive programs are going to do.
Gisclair was trying to balance the needs of the pollock industry with the needs of the salmon fishermen in the Yukon River who depend on salmon for survival. For Gisclair, setting the hard cap at 68,000, even if the pollock fishermen never intend to hit that mark, is too high.
We're concerned that hitting 68,000 ever is really too high for salmon. It's the third highest number that's ever been hit in Chinook salmon bycatch. And to us, that's not something that you set as your limit. That's something far beyond.
But there's at least one thing that both Gisclair and Gerber agree on. Every fish counts. For Gerber, one fish could destroy the season for a small pollock boat. For Gisclair, one fish could save the season for a small subsistence family. The advisory panel is recommending that the council set a hard cap limit of 68,392 Chinook salmon. Boats that participate in incentive programs through intercooperative agreements will get larger allocations than those that choose not to. If a boat reaches its limit, it can try to trade for another boat's allocation. Likewise, an ICA can also trade. 70% of a boat's allocated bycatch is for use during the A season and 30 for the B. But if a boat still has allocation left from A, it can be used later. This recommendation will be presented to the council during the meeting. The council is expected to make a final decision by Monday. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
During a brief visit to Ketchikan earlier this week, Governor Sarah Palin fielded a handful of questions regarding the Gravina Access Project and the amount of time she has spent in the first city during her tenure as governor. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Palin did not schedule any time with reporters during her hour-and-a-half visit to Ketchikan. She did, however, agree to a 4-minute impromptu interview as she exited Ketchikan's airport ferry Monday. This was Palin's first visit to Ketchikan since she catapulted onto the national political scene after being named John McCain's running mate. Vice presidential candidate Palin raised more than a few eyebrows in Ketchikan, and around the nation for that matter, when she repeatedly included the following claim in her campaign speeches.
I told the Congress, thanks but no thanks, on that bridge to nowhere.
That same bridge to nowhere statement was a popular applause line in Palin's speeches from Ohio to Pennsylvania. But there was just one problem. The state actually spent all of the money that was originally set aside for the bridge. The federal funding just went to different transportation projects around the state. On Monday, Palin was asked about her repeated use of the term bridge to nowhere during her vice presidential run. She says the phrase has been commonly used and was not meant as a slight to Ketchikan.
That's what it's been known as, but there is no nowhere in Alaska. Alaska is all potential. It's all good people. It's all potential resource development, and there is no nowhere in Alaska.
When asked if she would support the construction of a bridge in Ketchikan, Palin says the state is still evaluating Gravina access options, which currently include a number of bridge alternatives.
There's dollars in the budget for bridge options and ferry crossing options. So we're still interested in making sure that the good people in this area and the people who travel to this area have good modes of transportation.
Palin was also asked why she has spent so little time in Ketchikan since her election to statewide office.
I love coming to Ketchikan. I've spent time here, continue to spend time here, and will in the future. I wish that there were more hours in the day and that I could travel every day. It's kind of a catch-22 situation when you're in the middle of the legislative session, that's for sure, when lawmakers seem to have some heartburn over when I do leave the Capitol building. So kind of catch-22, but I will do what Alaskans need me to do to best serve them.
Palin spent an hour and a half in Ketchikan on Monday. Prior to that, she had visited Ketchikan twice since being elected governor. One of those times, her plane had overheaded and she was forced to land here. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The Most Reverend Edward J. Burns was installed yesterday as Bishop of the Diocese of Juneau. The installation mass was held at St. Paul the Apostle Catholic Church in Juneau before the Archbishops of Anchorage, as well as bishops from Fairbanks, Pittsburgh, Spokane, Boise, and Whitehorse. Burns has been a priest for 25 years, ordained in 1983, and serving since in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was appointed bishop in January to replace Bishop Michael Warfel, who has become the Bishop of Great Falls and Billings Diocese in Montana. The Catholic Church was first established in Southeast in 1879 in Wrangell. The Diocese of Juneau was established in 1951 by Pope Pius XII.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Alaska Supreme Court has ruled that a parent's privacy rights may be considered as a legitimate objection to a state-mandated tuberculosis test. Patrick Huffman and Amy Reedy Huffman believe that a purified protein derivative, or PPD, skin test would harm their two elementary-age boys. They applied for a waiver so that the boys could be enrolled at a Kenai Peninsula Borough school, but justices ruled that an affidavit signed by Huffman and a naturopath was not valid, since naturopaths are not physicians, as defined by state law. The justices also ruled that a simple philosophical objection to putting a harmful substance in one's body is not the same as expressing a religious belief. However, the justices did say that the Huffmans' decisions over medical treatment for their children is a fundamental liberty and privacy right. The case is being sent back to the lower court to determine if an alternative test for tuberculosis would satisfy the state's compelling interest to prevent the spread of the disease. The 3-day annual Chamai Dance Festival was held in Bethel last weekend. It draws about 24 dance groups and a few thousand onlookers every year. One of the favorite dancers each year is Scammon Bay elder Marianne Sundown. She is well known across the YK Delta and around the state for her Eskimo dancing. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Alice Criswell has the story.
Marianne Sundown's Yupik name is Aghanauchok. She grew up near the Bering Sea coast in the old Hooper Bay area called Napahayak before her family moved to Scammon Bay. Sundown says Yurak or Eskimo dancing started when the school came to their community, about the same time that the calendar came into use. She says she welcomed the dancing and she learned to Yurak mainly by watching the men dance and by hearing their songs. Over the last few decades, she has been a Jamai fixture, and the crowd always cheers loudly when she takes the stage. To the audience, she looks about the same each year, her tiny frame hunched over in a brightly colored kasbak and the usual smile on her face. At age 91, Sundown says she gets around these days using all of her strength. She says she worked very hard at Jamai this year, but had a lot of fun. Sundown says Eskimo dancing is a good, decent activity that is better than the Western or white people's dance. She says during Eskimo dancing, couples do not cuddle up to each other. Sundown says Yurak has changed a lot over the years. She said in the past, they didn't hold anything in their hands and did not wear headdresses. Even if the dancers had the headdress and dance fans, they didn't use them. She says there were not a lot of caribou to make the fans out of back then. Sundown says now people are lazy and buy their dance fans and headdresses and don't make their own. And now people have vehicles to get around easily, and they don't use sled dogs for travel anymore. Sundown has 12 children, and she had most of them at home without any help from anyone. She says no one will be like her anymore. I asked Sundown to tell me about a dance song and what it means. She sang and spoke about a dance called Ayunak. She told about this family with the last name of Rag. They were floating on the ocean or river and couldn't get to shore. One of the people in the boat, before he went to sleep, and without saying anything, put a loaded gun under himself with 5 shots in it. None of the others knew this. He was thinking if they were to be crushed by the ice floes, he would shoot his family one by one and then shoot himself because he didn't want them to suffer. But they somehow got to their land safely. Sundown says someone from Paimute, who didn't go with them in the boat, made a song of this true story. Sundown's dance group made up a song called the Twist Dance Song. And yes, it includes some twisting dance moves. It is one of Sundown's favorites because she says they have a lot of fun doing it. I'm Alice Criswell.
8th graders in Juneau were recently given a unique opportunity. They got to pick their public high school. March 20th was the deadline for turning in their high school choice intent forms, which will determine where they'll spend the next 4 years at Juneau Douglas High School or Thunder Mountain, built last year. KTOO's Rebecca Shear spent some time with Juneau's freshman-to-be and brings us this story.
Ask 8th graders Lindsay Smithberg, Jessica Miller, Abby Wilward, and Shayla Reeves what they think of the whole high school choice thing, and the answer is unanimous.
Scary.
It's scary.
Yeah,
and the decision we make, it affects our life. Scary.
Scary because they're leaving the cozy corridors of Floyd Dryden Middle School. Scary because high school is the great unknown. And scary because, as Shayla puts it, they might be facing that great unknown. Alone.
A whole, group of our friends that had made a pact with us, that we would all go to Thunder Mountain, changed their mind to go to JDHS, and, you know, it's hard to go which school you like best or which friends you want to stay with.
And that's the thing. These girls are in 8th grade, and for many in that age group,
they want to go where their friends are going.
Or so says 8th grade Floyd Dryden teacher Jeanette Sleppy.
I mean, they're pretty young teenagers, so they're focused on social aspect right now.
But a lot of them also are going to TMHS because it's near their house. So
That's been a big thing, too.
Leah Hyman teaches 8th grade science at Floyd Dryden. Sleppy teaches language arts.
A select group of students, they're choosing specifically JDHS because they feel that the most talented football players are choosing that school.
No mention so far of the academic programs.
As much as we would like them to focus on the academics.
But as it turns out, many of them are. Like Trevor Pfaff.
I'm in 8th grade and I go to Floyd Dryden Middle School.
Trevor's chosen JDHS for next year.
Because the football.
Okay, sure, but that's not the only reason.
I'm thinking JDHS because the muscle studies program there.
Muscle studies?
Mm-hmm.
What's muscle studies?
Like, before you come become a PE teacher or anything with doing sports, you have to learn the basic muscles of your body before you go into college about it.
Which is precisely what Trevor wants to do. And he says if they had muscle studies at Thunder Mountain, he'd probably go there instead.
And did everyone receive Welcome to High School, choosing your high school in Juneau? Inside there is a little postcard that gives you a choice. You check one of those marks, and you're going to check Thunder Mountain High School.
Catherine Milliron isn't entirely kidding. As Thunder Mountain's vice principal, she's hoping many 8th graders will choose her school. That's why the week before the decision deadline...
Do you have other questions?
She's leading a Q&A session for parents.
What's a 9th grader start out with?
What does a freshman take?
Yeah.
Lots of hard classes.
Okay, this time Milliron is kidding. In fact, a major draw of Thunder Mountain, she says...
Some little bit of fun classes.
In other words, electives like culinary arts, digital engineering, and robotics. Add that to the fact that Thunder Mountain is brand new this year.
And the future of this seed that's been planted this year, we've watered it, but we're trying still to grow our numbers in JDHS. They're trying to retain their numbers.
We started the school year with 1,068 students. We started last year with some 1,500, so it does feel a little cozier and smaller.
But, says Juneau Douglas High School Principal Bernie Sorensen, cozier and smaller can actually be better. Discipline issues are down threefold. Students are getting more personalized attention.
Because we're giving choice. It is making us all stand to attention and rethink hard about what does our school really offer so that we can meet the individual needs of the diverse student population that we have.
Not to mention the one they'll have next year. Sorensen anticipates half of Juneau's 8th graders choosing JDHS in 2009, just as they did in 2008. That's about 200 students. As to whether future freshmen Shayla, Lindsay, Jessica, and Abby will be part of that 200, well...
So have you guys actually turned in your cards yet? Have you officially decided?
I have. I'm going to Thunder Mountain.
My mom did.
I chose Thunder Mountain.
The only one still up in the air is Abby, who's trying to decide between academics and, yes, friends. But as Shayla says, all the peer groups, the pacts, that's not what's really important.
Everywhere is different. Everybody's different. You'll meet new people, weird or cool. Doesn't matter. It's our future.
And that future begins August 31st, when Juneau's 400 ninth graders grab their backpacks and march through the doors of their new academic home for the next 4 years. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Alice Criswell in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Ed Schoenfeld, Rosemarie Alexander, Matt Miller, and Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.